welcome to Emery's Creativity Conversations podcast. This is our fourth season, spring 2021, with these introductory interviews taking place virtually. This podcast takes Rosemary McGee Creativity Conversations, a live endowed speaker series on Emory's campus, and turns them into podcasts. I'm Maggie Becker, the host and producer of this podcast. I work for Emory Arts, and I'm an Emory alum of theater studies and creative writing. Today, I'm joined virtually by the Rosemary McGee Fellow in the Arts, Emory alum, and burgeoning art historian, Rizky Etika, to introduce the 2010 creativity conversation between Margaret Atwood and Rosemary McGee herself. The point of these introductions is to provide an exciting way to continue the conversation on creativity. Rizky and I will chat about Atwood's thoughts, Rizky's own life, and creating in general. Rizky, why don't you introduce yourself?
Thanks, Maggie. Hi, my name is Rizky Etika. Maggie's given a really nice introduction, and I'm really excited to be here.
So, Rizky, why did you pick this conversation between Margaret Atwood and Rosemary McGee?
Well, first, I went to the YouTube page, and I scrolled all the way to the bottom, thinking that would be the most recent creativity conversation, and it turned out to be one of the first. And to my delight, it was the creativity conversation with Margaret Atwood, who's a bit of a literary legend, at least from my childhood growing up. That being said, I've only ever read one of her books, but a lot of my teachers and mentors just lauded her. So she has a place in my head.
So what was the book that you ended up reading? Was it Handmaid's Tale?
Yeah. It was, I read The Handmaid's Tale, I think, right before the Netflix show came out. That's the one that I guess now is maybe her most famous book, but at the time of the conversation with Rosemary McGee, I think that was just one of her many famous books.
Yeah, I definitely read Handmaid's Tale in high school. And like you're saying, Margaret Atwood kind of becomes this big figure. I feel like anybody's books you read in high school, you're like, well, that is like a sampling of at least American major canon. Of course, we miss out on some of the minority voices, but of the traditional American canon, Margaret Atwood is amongst them.
What was actually interesting is I didn't realize until hearing the conversation, she's actually Canadian, but in my head, she was always one of the American, modern great authors, but she's actually from Canada.
Right. Well, then I guess it's Western canon is the more appropriate term. So were you surprised by anything that Margaret Atwood said, or is there anything that stuck out to you? Because I do think these authors that we get introduced to in high school that are Western canon, we kind of just assume that they're all maybe a little stuffy and traditional, even though Handmaid's Tale is pretty, for lack of better words, spicy.
I don't think I went into it expecting her to be pretentious or stuffy, but I do remember her being introduced to me, and I mean this in the most reverent way possible. She was baby's first feminist lit. Before you read Judith Butler or Audre Lorde, you read Margaret Atwood. And she doesn't seem to appreciate that characterization, or maybe she doesn't want to be reduced to that, to just feminism. One of the first questions Rosemary talks to her about is about one of her earliest books, Surfacing. She talks about the feminist mythology or the mythology of the self, and immediately Margaret Atwood stops her and then gives her a brief history of feminism, a brief history of first and second wave feminism, and she's just essentially implying I am more than just this, but this is still this is something you need to know about. If that makes sense.
It does. Well, so I'm a comedian, amongst many other things, but I often am called a female comedian, which is not something I want to deny, as it's part of the perspective that I bring to my comedy. But it also means I don't want to be niched into when they're doing a lineup and they're like, all right, well, we need a guy, we need a minority, and we need a white lady. I don't want to be the female comedian. I want to just be there because I'm funny and I deserve to be there. Do you ever encounter that when you are kind of getting into art history? Do you ever find yourself either pushing against these, let's put people in a box? Or is that something that helps you find and get into the history of creative work?
Well, there's definitely the habit of tokenization in a lot of communities that I've been in. I've been very lucky, at least at Emory, where there's been movements to encompass as many voices as possible. There's a distinct awareness in the art history department where they know that the faculty and staff all look mostly similar. Most of them came from the same backgrounds, but they're, or at least the ones that I have met, work with others who are trying to democratize the space to make it more accessible to others. And that's one of the driving factors of what I want to do career-wise.
Talk to me about art history. I know that sounds like a silly question, but as someone who comes from what seems more standard, like if I tell you I'm in theater, then you can kind of picture in your head like a stage, some lights, that kind of thing. But when I think art history, I don't know, I picture like Da Vinci's Code, like somebody's like looking at a painting and it's telling them their secrets. But what is art history to you?
Da Vinci's Code is a really like fun version of like what I imagine. It's like national treasure. But for academics, I suppose, art history to me is a reflection of society and that we like glean stories from, preserving traces of the past. But of course, the thing about art history, I'm usually studying like the wealthy people's like items and houses. I'm going to focus on architectural art history. So the majority of what I'll be studying is going to be the most opulent and like wealthy versions of history. But I see a lot of value in preserving those histories. But art history is kind of, I find that it tends to be the butt of the joke in a lot of not humanities academics, but within, if I go to Georgia Tech and I tell my friends there that I'm studying art history, their first words are like, you're doomed, or why? But I've found a lot of growth and like enrichment in this field. And I will defend it, you know, to any naysayers.
Well, no need to defend it to me, and certainly not as a way to prove it. But what is the value of art history? What does what you learn teach us?
It's a very interdisciplinary field that I don't think a lot of people realize, because in the past, before art was more accessible to other people, it was how the most powerful rulers or wealthy showed their power. The first museums were basically how imperial powers showed off their riches from other colonies, or it was for patrons in Catholic Rome to demonstrate how pious they were, or rather just to show like they had the means to accumulate that version of wealth. You also see art being an expression of, again, power. When you see the ruins of Greece and Rome, those huge monuments were how those rulers demonstrated their abilities to create something lasting. Art history is a way to study history visually and viscerally to me. And you often have to understand the socioeconomic, psychological backgrounds of the creators and the people who that art was supposed to communicate to.
I like this explanation that you have, because I also am kind of getting this vibe that art history is kind of like archaeology. And you get to uncover some truths, but of course you only have to infer what doesn't get to be preserved. And like you're saying, it only gives you a slice of things, because oftentimes it's easier to preserve what, like the bigger things, like giant statues that are erected by kings and leaders, and fancy things like really expensive dresses and things that have been preserved because the royalty had them. Do you ever, like, I don't know, how do you explore the smaller voices? Are you able to?
Oh yeah, I know when it comes to the relationship between archaeology and art history is very, very intertwined, right? They go wild whenever they see trash from like a poor person's home that was preserved. And it's because those stories are the ones in the past you rarely saw being kept, they've become almost more valuable because it provides a more complete picture of life, of the human condition. That matters, like now, 50 years ago, and like 30,000 years ago. We now have, I think, like a bigger capability to preserve those voices, and the project on like Humans of New York, where they create, you know, profiles of people's stories. It's normal people. It's everyone from like the grandma from down the street, the bodega owner, the sex worker, anybody. And I find even though art is more accessible now, there's an even bigger push from the other side to keep it exclusive. The tension is there, right? There's people, you know, I don't want to say like me, who are trying to keep it more democratized and open to everybody and make it more digestible. But there's also like a group who want to keep it elevated. And I'm sure in their mind, it's to keep it like, you know, pure art. But I think that's to the detriment of the field.
I agree. I am also just picturing, I wish like we could tell these people from hundreds of years ago that one day someone would care that they found their like sunflower seeds from what they ate for like a snack, you know? And it's like, people are gonna care about these things, these small bits of human life. How do you see yourself working to continue to democratize art history?
Well, I definitely am trying to go the more traditional route, you know, go to grad school and hopefully do research for a museum, maybe hopefully become a curator one day for, I want to study Islamic art and architecture. So there are very limited positions for that field. But once you're in those spaces, you get to design the conversation and how art is presented to the public. If you work for the Smithsonian, you know, that's thousands of, I mean, you know, prior to last year, that would have been, you know, thousands of people. That would have been everybody's eighth grade field trip. And that stays with people, like what they see just, or as a little kid, just when you're walking through, if you're told that these are the stories that you need to remember, but also that those stories are accessible to you and that you yourself are welcome to explore those stories, you have a lot of power when you're in those positions. And I'm hoping that I could use those powers for good if I should ever get into that position.
Well, there's something beautiful about letting everyone access these stories when they've been consciously and kindly curated. I think we've really let certain communities, certainly in the United States, be radicalized and dramatized, and a lot of people lose sight of the fact that those people are their neighbors and friends and live human lives and eat sunflower seeds just like everybody else. So I think that's really amazing. Rizky, thank you so much for joining me and just having a nice conversation about creativity with me. To our listeners, please enjoy this creativity conversation. It has been edited down a little bit from its original, so if you'd like to see the original, I have linked that YouTube video in the description of this episode.
Thanks, everybody, for being here. I'm Rosemary McGee, Vice President and Secretary of the University, and I'm joined, of course, by Margaret Atwood, who is one of these people who truly does need no introduction. But since I get to ask the first question, I am going to actually start with towards the beginning of your career, with surfacing. And the reason I want to do that is because when I was the ages of these students, I read this novel, and I felt like it was my novel. I felt like it was about my consciousness and my journey, even though the protagonist in this novel has, you know, on the face of it, had nothing whatsoever to do with me and my life. But it was the inner life that I think struck a chord. And so I just like for us to talk for just a few minutes about surfacing and that journey, but then also the larger question of how it is over these 40 years that you've been able to stay connected to sort of a, what I would call a collective literary consciousness that all of us have the opportunity to participate, something at the moment that speaks to the larger emotions of a generation or of a group, as this book did for me. So anyway, just any thoughts you have about surfacing or how you see this novel now in your...
Well, let's see, now that's a while ago. It was the second novel that I wrote, the first being called The Edible Woman. The Edible Woman is an anti-comedy in that with the comedy form, it usually ends with the marriage of the hero and the heroine. And surfacing ends with a non-marriage, and then two other people get married that you think are probably quite a bad idea. So as a form, it's an anti-comedy. as a form surfacing as a ghost story.
Meaning and that it's full of ghosts.
It's a ghost story.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That is what it is as a form. So you don't notice that, of course, because the ghosts are presented in a somewhat different way. But having been a student of the late 19th century ghost story, if you think of, for instance, Henry James' mm-hmm. Jolly Corner, you know that ghost story?
I do, but just very vaguely.
Okay.
So it might be useful.
Turn of the Screw is probably a bit better known. Mm-hmm. And if you read The Turn of the Screw very carefully, it's not at all clear whether or not the narrator is crazy, whether she has made it all up or not. You're not entirely sure. You believe her the first time through, but then if on second thought you think, I'm not too sure about this. In the Jolly Corner, the man is haunted by the ghost of himself as he would have been if he had stayed in America rather than moving to Europe. So what he finally sees at the end is an alternate version of himself. Anyway, I was very interested in the ghost story as a form. So that is one of the things that underlies the structure mm-hmm. of surfacing.
Just beneath the surface.
That probably isn't the answer that you were looking for.
Well, I think that many people felt that it was a kind of a feminist inner experiential
if
moment.
You place a woman, if you have a woman as a narrator, a lot of people are going to read it as feminist,
especially in the wilderness. The wilderness dimension.
I was the first person to actually do that since the 19th century, as far as I can tell. If you go back to things like Girl of the Limberlost, mm-hmm. and even the Susanna Moody and Catherine Parr Trail books in Canada, there are women encountering the wilderness, and there is one by Ethel Wilson earlier in Canadian literature, but it's a good subject for me because that's where I grew up, so I didn't have a big problem with it.
Right.
What can I tell you about it? First wave feminism was in the late 19th century. It was called the woman question. And it exercised a lot of people, and the main drive of it was to get votes for women.
Mm-hmm.
And they ultimately did get votes for women. And then there was something called the person's case in Canada, which was, are women persons or are they not persons? It turned out they were persons, but they had to go to England to get the person's case decided. And it was about whether or not women could be senators. The law said that senators had to be persons, so that some people said, well, women actually aren't persons. It's so crazy. You think of this stuff, you look back on it, and you think, why were they arguing about that? But they were.
Right. Seems self-evident
okay,
now.
So once women had the vote and became persons, since that had been the goal of those movements, they kind of slacked off. And we had the Roaring Twenties, we had Depression in the 30s, in which during the 30s, it was not done. It was not considered good manners or even sometimes legal for a man and a married woman to both have jobs, because it was considered appropriate for the man to have the job and to support the family. And if you were, however, divorced or single, then it was okay for you to have a job. And then came the 40s, everything reversed again. Women had to work in factories making bombs, and Rosie the Riveter was the comic book character that went with that. She had her hair done up in a bandana, worked in a factory, and had on a jumpsuit. Rosie the Riveter, an important female figure.
Mm-hmm.
But then, quite deliberately, when the war was over, people brought in the domestic bliss, togetherness concept, and heavy emphasis on a certain version of Freudianism that said you weren't really fulfilled unless you didn't have a brain. Had to have your brain removed and live in a house without walls so you could be together with your kids all the time. Does that sound like fun to you? From a child's point of view, your mom is always there fulfilling herself through you. I think maybe not. And that's what Betty Friedan came out
mm-hmm.
of. It wasn't my experience as a Canadian person, because we were so benighted we never got that part. So we still had strong female persons amongst us. There were persons who did not tell us that the aim of our being at college was to get educated so we could have good dinner table conversation for the guests that her husband would bring home for business. We were never told that. Mm-hmm. My peers in the United States were told it. People mm-hmm. my age, that's what they were told. Mm-hmm. I shriek in horror, but that's what they were told. So then it was the 60s. Betty Friedan had published The Feminine Mystique, I think about 61.
Yeah, early 60s, then, right.
Early 60s. Simone de Beauvoir had published The Second Sex, which was about the education of French little girls of her generation, which was some years ago. She was still worried about the frilly dresses, which had not been my child experience. I longed for frilly dresses. I just didn't get any of them because my mother was a tomboy and she had no interest in clothes whatsoever. So the frilly dresses sounded good to me, but they did not sound good to Simone de Beauvoir. She was writing about them. So I did read both of these books. I didn't really connect with them at a visceral level because they were not my experience. Mm-hmm. I was a generation after the togetherness thing. I always thought it was stupid. The frilly dresses were remote for me. So I was really pre-second wave feminism. I actually wrote The Edible Woman in 1964, which is pretty early to be writing a second wave feminist book because it hadn't happened
yet. Right, it wasn't out in the popular culture so much.
At all, or even anywhere.
Right.
People read these books in the bathroom with the door locked. They didn't want to be caught doing it. So when second wave feminism hit around 1968-9, connected with the civil rights movement, because some of the people who had been in the civil rights movement and had felt undervalued as women within it, then got into feminism through that, they were looking for really any books written by women at all. And therefore, The Edible Woman, surfacing Alice Munro's first book called The Lives of Girls and Women, they were all taken to be feminist books, although they had not, in fact, been produced by the feminist second wave movement. They were pre-feminist. They were people who were doing this stuff on their own. So that's its relation to feminism. It was not produced by feminism, but it was adopted by it.
Absolutely.
As every book by every woman available in any way was.
But this novel in particular seems to pick up on kind of the idea of the mythic journey and also the journey inward.
Absolutely true. Mythic journeys and journeys inward have been typical of literature for a long time, and they are not confined to women.
Right.
By any means.
No, in fact, largely, oftentimes, the mythic journeys that we hear about or experience, or certainly in that era did, were often, women often felt like they weren't included in those journeys.
They had not read Grimm's Fairy Tales, unexpurgated version, complete. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of mythic journeys by women in it, like really a lot. Now, what happened to Grimm's Fairy Tales in the 50s was that it got Barbie dolled. They pinked it up. They took out all the bad parts. They took out all the pecked out eyeballs, red hot shoes, people being rolled downhill in barrels full of spikes. They thought that little children would be traumatized by that, which was wrong for most little children. And they made it very, very Walt Disney's Sleeping Beauty. They left in the ones about princesses being awakened by a kiss or dancing all night in well-decorated underground locations. But they took out the mythic journeys in which the girl figure is really up against it and gets through by either magic or being smart. So when you put those back in,
right,
you find that there are a lot of mythic journeys by female figures in those tales, most of which were told by women. So why wouldn't there be? I, in fact, had that book, lucky me, because my parents sent away for it by mail order, not knowing that it was going to have all those pecked out eyeballs and red hot shoes in it. And then they tried to sort of keep it from us, but it was too late.
Well, that made it all the more interesting,
yeah,
right?
So that when the feminist movement started saying fairy tales are anti-woman, they just hadn't read the right ones. They'd read those Disneyfied, pinky, frilly versions that were not authentic.
So, to
the real shocker about Grimm's is that a lot of those stepmothers in Grimm's brothers could not stand the idea that those were actually mothers. and they changed a lot of the mothers into stepmothers. They left the mother in Hansel and Gretel. Those are the parents who abandoned those kids in the woods. But most of them they changed to stepmothers. Any mothers they found that were behaving badly, they changed into stepmothers.
Showing that that is opposite to the maternal instinct that we're supposedly have.
Well, I think the Grimm's brothers just couldn't man up to it.
And so I want to connect this.
They were collecting these tales in the age of romantic motherhood. They're very influenced by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. So they didn't want to have the earlier, more vicious mothers.
And also that idea of romantic motherhood was kind of re-enchanted in the 50s, especially around, you know, TV sitcoms.
Well, those TV sitcoms, when you go back and look at them, are quite interesting because the mother figures are generally either smarter or more devious than the inept dads.
So mother does know best.
It's not that she knows best. Lucia Ball is a ditz, but she somehow wins out.
Mm-hmm. A wise fool.
Well, partly because she's the feature of the show. Mm-hmm. She's the star, so she's going to win out, isn't she? But she wins out in a comic way that isn't too threatening.
So anyway, all of these things are going on in the culture around you and in your literary background, and you end up writing a novel that becomes just, you know, taken up by so many people. Not all of these people, women in particular, were social activists, although many were.
Yeah, well, I can tell you a funny story about that novel. The first editor of it was a man, and he first promoted it as a book about hunting and fishing. And his first audience was guys who then thought, what? There isn't enough fishing in this for me. Uh-huh. And women stayed away from it because they thought it was about hunting and fishing. But then they kind of figured it out and things turned around.
Yeah, so it had a different audience than what he was perhaps anticipating.
I don't know what he was anticipating. He was thinking about James Dickey. You know, odd things happening in the woods.
He's a local artist.
He didn't really, I don't think anybody quite knew in 1970, 71, too, exactly. It's more or less like when e-books hit publishing. Nobody quite knew what it was.
Right.
And it was the same with second wave feminism, which began by being presented as a bunch of lunatics. And people hadn't quite figured out where that was going at all. So I think he was thinking in terms of traditional publishing, you know, how you would present a book with hunting and fishing in it. He was very keen on it. He was viewing it in an odd way. And I have to tell you that the first paperback of it had a big ad for menthol cigarettes right in the middle of it in color. And I said, what is this doing here?
I actually had that version of it, but it's falling apart, so
yeah.
I bought a new one. Yeah.
It's unique. I said, why is this ad for cigarettes in my book? And he said, well, the contract doesn't say we can't.
So watch out for those contracts.
But who would think that they would do that? You know, it's like warnings on products. You can actually buy bags full of peanuts that say this bag may contain peanuts. And you think, well, who would ever get it into their head that it wouldn't? but you never know.
So anyway, let's connect this to what I'm calling a literary cultural consciousness. Which
means, how do I know?
How do you know?
I just know.
That's right. It has a very...
I'm not thinking about it.
Right.
I'm just thinking about what I'm interested in at the moment. I'm not thinking, boy, this is part of the literary cultural consciousness.
No, I'm sure that
I don't actually know what the literary cultural consciousness is, and neither does anybody until about 3 years later, or five, or ten. Marcia McLuhan is absolutely right. We are always looking in the rearview mirror. So we see what just happened, but it's very hard for us to see what's happening right now. We don't have enough data.
Although sometimes it can happen almost, or seem to happen almost immediately.
There are definitive moments. There are turning moments. 9/11 is a turning moment. The outbreak of World War II is a turning moment. There are those moments. And historians can say, well, this was the buildup. But people who are living through the buildup often didn't know it, didn't get it at the time at all.
Right. But there can be a moment when a work of art, a film, a novel appears on the landscape.
And it inserts itself into the consciousness because that happens to be, although nobody knew it, that happens to be, as it turns out, what people wanted to read about or think about right then. But you can't anticipate that, and publishers drive themselves crazy trying to anticipate it. They're always trying to get somebody else to write Harry Potter, you know, after Harry Potter actually has been done. So it's not Harry Potter in an inferior imitation. It's not all the people who imitated Anne of Green Gables, because none of them will ever be the original one.
We also spoke earlier about Anne of Green Gables as a literary figure, at least for me, who influenced my life and my sense as a girl. Any of you all read the Anne books? Yeah. Okay, great. So I'm glad.
I very carefully explained also to you earlier that guys were unlikely to have read this book. Had an older brother, I know what they read.
So if you're ever an English teacher, and you'll have the opportunity to assign some books that the different groups would not ordinarily read, and I would put Anne of Green Gables among those. But I want to talk about how, you know, what I saw and experienced and enjoyed was surfacing as something that has happened several times throughout your literary life and career. To me, that speaks something about the topic that we're on about today, and that is the topic of creativity. You know, there's a creative magic. There's some sort of creative magic that we might be able to describe or define or point to in retrospect, and probably if you tried to make it happen, would escape you. And so my question is, how do you nurture that kind of creative spirit or openness?
In other people.
Either in yourself or in other people.
In myself, it's really just a question of time. It's a question of available time, and it's as simple as that. So time, vitamin pills, if you're the age that you are now, I would say start doing your back exercises now. Pilates are good, keep a strong core. It does help your brain to go for walks, all of that is true. All that boring stuff your mom told you, it's all true. Because really we're talking about brain activity. So what is going to help your brain activity is going to help your creativity. And the rest of it, I would say, if you have a real problem, go to sleep. And when you wake up, you may well have the answer. Your brain will work for you. Let us call it your mind. Your mind will work for you when you're not looking. And it's more likely to work for you when you're not looking if you have come to a real wall. So those are just things that people do and have found during many centuries of thinking about this. It's also true that it is practice. You're not going to learn to be a wonderful composer unless you do those finger exercises, unless you learn about music, unless you immerse yourself in music. So with writing, it's reading and reading and reading and writing and writing and writing, and there is no substitute for that.
So do you surround yourself with vast expanses of time, unstructured time?
I wish. Not right now. Maybe beginning in December. I happen to have overbooked myself this fall. But you'd be surprised how much you can accomplish on airplanes.
Well, yeah, it's hard to, right now, it's still hard to check your voicemails and your blogs and your emails while you're on the airplane. But
Yes, and that is a blessing.
Right. So part of it is a complication we have now is the invasiveness of technology.
Which you can, again, it's like any new technology. When it first hits, people are mesmerized by it. It was the same with the telephone. It was the same with radio. It was the same with television. We now sort of take them for granted. Everybody has them, but we use them more sparingly. We're not sitting in front of them with TV trays and our mouth open, eating our dinner in a sort of zombie trance the way people did from about 1954 to about 1960. You would go along the street and every window would be blue because television in those days was black and white and it gave off a blue aura. You'd look in and here would be these people just...
So we can hope for the new technology to get over our current addiction.
People will use it as a tool. They will come to use it more sparingly. they will not be so mesmerized by it. It'll take a while, because it has with every technology. And you already find some young people saying, well, e-books are all right for my mother, but I prefer paper ones. Just as we see a reversion to vinyl records, which are now sort of a cool collector's taste. So all of these things go through cycles. They're all, of course, very dependent on power supply. So when the lights go out, they're actually no use to you.
So you mentioned that reading as well as writing constantly, and you seem to have a really wide array of types of works that you read, you know, from economics to comic strips to fairy tales to, I imagine, modern fiction. Is that just an eclectic taste? Is that something you just wander around in?
It's an eclectic taste. It does come from growing up in the woods, in which there were these many books, and you read them, and then you read them all again, because you couldn't actually go get more. There weren't any more. There was no library. There were no actual people. So you read what was there, and that included everything from detective novels, of which my dad was quite fond, to biology textbooks, to history, to just whatever happened to be there.
Edgar Allan Poe, you mentioned yesterday.
I got that from the library. I discovered libraries, the little library card that you get a stamp on. That's where I got those books. Whoever lent them to me, I can't imagine, but they did.
And what about now? What do you read now?
Oh, I read whatever happens to be there. When I'm at the doctor's or dentist's office, I make my way through Elle, Marie Claire, Vanity Fair, and all of the other fashion magazines to see what's on their minds these days. Every once in a while, I might dip into Harlequin romances. Not often, but every 10 years or so, to see if what's changed. I can tell. The guys talk more than they used to. They didn't used to talk at all. And the women, they just sort of smoldered. Right now, the women can have much better jobs than they used to have. Used to be nurses or picture restorers was the thing that they could be, because then you got to go to the mansion, the creepy mansion, to restore the pictures. They could be governesses, they could be something that ill. Now they get to run their own antique furniture businesses and things like that. You get more sex these days. It used to be the clinch on page. And there were formulas for these. I know people used to write them. And they would send you the formula sheet, first kiss on page 32, this happens this, and then at the end this happens. And they would tell you what had to happen.
So we saw yesterday some of your early literary creations. Did you ever do one of these?
I expand my range of reading. Yes, I read modern novels.
Okay.
I read other ones that I've enjoyed in the past. I'm a reading addict, so it kind of doesn't matter. I'll begin anything. I don't always finish them, but I begin them.
And any particular writers that we would recognize that you feel like inform
your... I'm very careful about giving lists, because the ones who aren't on them do hear about it. And then they think you've left them off on purpose because you don't like them. And that's usually not true,
right.
But it can create a chill. So I don't usually make lists if I can avoid it, unless the people are dead. I'll do dead people. It's safer.
Well, before we turn this over to the students, I want to ask you a question about art in general. I saw in an interview that was posted on the web, I think one that you did recently, where there was a statement that people nowadays just aren't interested in art. And essentially, in response to that, you said, they're just dead wrong. People are interested in
art. Yeah, they're very interested in it.
And so I'm interested in two parts of this question. One is, when you say you believe people are interested in art, what you mean by that, and also why we seem to have this general cultural perception that we're not interested in art, especially Americans, that Americans are not interested in art.
They have a limited definition of what they mean by art.
Mm-hmm.
People are very interested in doing art themselves, although it might not be Picasso, it might be sweater knitting, might be designing their living room or something like that. They're very involved in all of that. Dennis Dutton's book called The Art Instinct is probably what you want to take a look at, especially the first part, where he says that particularly the narrative art, but the other ones too, are undoubtedly evolved adaptations that we acquired during the this many years we spent in the Pleistocene, as opposed to the this many years we have spent in historically recorded society. And if they are evolved adaptations, it's because they gave us an edge. They gave us a survival edge in that dangerous environment. And if you think about it a bit, you can see why that doubtless was so. But if you look at what kids do spontaneously before they're five, they learn to talk, they sing, they all sing a lot, they twirl about, they dance, they make visual images, mm-hmm. and they tell and understand stories at a remarkably early age. They understand them before they tell them, but then they get around to telling them. These are doubtless the programs that we come with, and unless we're put in an environment that actively discourages them, that's what kids will do. So that's part of being human.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why people are interested in it and why they make YouTubes of themselves singing songs rather badly, but pop stars they admire sing rather well. And why they endlessly look at pictures of other people
mm-hmm.
dressed up in funny clothes, whether that be in fashion magazines or at Comic-Con or dressing up as Trekkies and going to Star Wars conventions or any of these sorts of things. Halloween, Mardi Gras, they're all very popular because you get to transform yourself. We love that at moments. We don't want to do it every day, but once in a while, we like to be somebody else.
And so you would describe and include these under that general heading of art?
It all is art.
And do you see any distinctions there between art that is popular art or art that is...
Okay, in a hunter-gatherer society, everybody does everything. Mm-hmm. We have developed into a very specialized society in which you have to have something called a job to make something called money, and then you get something called a mortgage. A job is something for which other people will pay the money to do the mortgage and all of that. So that means that a lot of people just suppress the things that they would rather be doing. And they put those off to the side. They're going to do that when they retire, or else they do it on weekends. And some of it involves playing games, such as dreaded golf and other sorts of games like that. But a lot of it has to do with making, building, inventing, creating. There's something online called Spore. Does anybody know about Spore? It was put out there by the people who did SimCity, and it said, invent a creature. They thought they would get this many people uploading creatures. They got a number that is bigger than this room. It was exponential, the amount that people wanted to play with this and invent their own things. So that creativity mm-hmm. is just inherent, and everybody has some version of it. Scratch them, they may say, oh, art, you know, that's not for me, I don't understand it. What they mean is art in galleries. They don't mean what they're doing with their woodworking set in the cellar. That's not supposed to be art. But it's actually all part of the same continuum. So in our specialized society, we invented dentists, and we invented kidney doctors, and we invented, like, ants. We invented little groups of people who do this thing, this one thing, very well, and we depend on them for that. And we also develop a specialized cast of people we call artists, who are professional, and that's their vocation, that's what they're known for, that's what they do during the day.
Such as yourself.
Such as myself. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that other people do not have the interest, the capacity, the involvement. Sure they do. Otherwise they wouldn't bother going to movies.
And nowadays they have YouTube, so there's a way to have an audience.
You can have an audience sometimes inadvertently. Sometimes you have an audience that you don't actually want to have. But, and it's not always art up there. It's sometimes a policeman yelling at somebody. But it's all sorts of things up there, and some of it is certainly art that people have made.
Well, if this kind of creativity impulse is embedded in us, which I also believe, and it is actually the premise of these creativity conversations, and if part of it is to the propagation of the species, let's say, it's part of our evolutionary makeup, storytelling has a particular...
That's very simple. You can tell the younger progeny of your tribe, Uncle Charlie got eaten by a crocodile right over there. Don't go there. You don't actually have to go there and get eaten by the crocodile to find out that that's the place you shouldn't go. Conversely, this is how we hunted the mammoth and the Jean Nam Aul mammoth hunter series. This is how we got hold of a giraffe last time we went giraffe hunting, and here's how you do it. Come with us, we'll show you, but first of all, we're going to act it out and let you know what to expect. And should I, Uncle Charlie, who didn't get eaten by the crocodile, should I suddenly fall over dead? Because I've told you this, because I've suddenly fallen over dead at the age of 30, which was probably when I would, because I've been able to tell you this, and in those days, not just tell you, but sing it to you and act it out, you are going to have a much better idea of what to expect when you have to go get your own giraffe, because I am no longer with you, although I will be helping you from the spirit world.
So that's a protective quality of storytelling.
Yes.
But it seems like there's another...
Protective and instructive.
Right. So, but it seems like there's also another quality that is an intrinsic to it, which is the imaginative possibilities of stories that are worlds or ways of being
that's
or living our lives.
That's what we do now. Then it was probably much as I have described, but we're talking about an original pattern that, like all of things we do, has exfoliated into a great many forms. So once upon a time there was a spear. It was a weapon. Now just count the numbers of other weapons that we have developed since then. Okay, so you have a sort of central idea. I am going to hit somebody with something that is at a removed from myself, so that I will be in less danger when I stick this piece of pointed rock into them. And that's what weapons are. It's being able to harm somebody at a distance, so you don't actually have to strangle them and run the risk of being strangled yourself. The further you are from your target, the safer you are, supposing your aim is.
But there may also be a protective evolutionary benefit to imagining
possibilities. Yes. Behind that rock, a panther may lurk, or it may not lurk.
Right.
But you might as well be prepared for the fact that it might.
Or you might be able to imagine a creature of a different sort.
As they frequently did. And so sometimes that's counterproductive because you scare yourself so silly that you incapacitate yourself. But we do.
And the monster story.
Well, the monster story has a function. For little children, it's showing that you can encounter scary things and deal with it, survive it, come through, it'll be okay.
So imagining things that don't actually exist or don't exist yet can prepare us for those things that might happen to us.
That's one line of thinking. Mm-hmm. It's no good, by the way, to tell kids that there isn't a monster under the bed. That doesn't work. You have to say, well, there is one, but I've had a conversation with it. Or I've sprinkled the magic soap flakes. So it has to stay under. It's not going to come out. Mm-hmm. It's, oh, okay.
Well, speaking of things that inspire our imagination, I really want to open this up to students who have read and commented on some of your more recent work that has had an effect on them based on what your early work had on me. And so I want to open this up to those questions or comments or ideas that you may have. Go ahead and say your name again, and then your question.
I'm Anna. So my question is, this has to do with The Handmaid's Tale, but some of your other novels too. When you write a book that has an open-ended finish, which I understand is intentional, do you personally have you wrapped up your characters' lives, or do you continue to let them live in your imagination? Do you know what you think happened to her?
On Mondays, she got found out and recaptured. On Wednesdays, she made her way to England.
So you leave it as open-ended as the readers are left?
Would I lie to you? No, it's true about history that sometimes people just vanish. You don't know what happened to them because the records are burnt up or were never made in the first place. So some people, you can follow their story, and you find people writing history books, say, about the years of the Black Death, for instance, we know when they were born, we know who they married, and this and that and this and that, and then they just disappear. Things got too chaotic. So you actually just can't follow the story anymore. Or Grace Marks, an alias Grace. We know that she went to the United States to, quotes, a home prepared. Then she obviously did what you would do. She changed her name. Nobody can find her after that. She vanishes. Doesn't mean that she herself vanished. It means that we don't know. We cannot trace her any further. So with somebody like the speaker in Handmaid's Tale, she left a record for us. But we don't know what happened to her after that. Might have been a good thing, might have been a bad thing. We just don't know. And history is like that. It's filled with trails that come to abrupt ends. Not because the person did, the records do.
I'm Jenna. I was hoping you can go into what inspired you to write Oryx and Drake, and also whether you kind of envision humanity going in that direction.
It's going in that direction already.
Yeah, I think so too, but I wanted to see what you thought about it.
Okay, what inspired me? I grew up with the biologist, and part of my reading is pop biology. And by pop biology, I mean the part where I did not actually have to do the experiment myself or the math, but somebody else will kindly tell me what they have discovered with pictures. Yes. So I just keep up with that. My brother is a biologist. He's a neurophysiologist. He sends me abstracts of mice hormones and other things he thinks might interest me.
Do they?
Yes, of course. Therefore, I just have that. I didn't have to go out specially starting from nothing and deal with that. I just have it. In fact, my family was rather disappointed that I did not take up that line of work. So that was there, and also being involved with conservation from way back and looking at the rates of extinctions. So it came out of that, really, and the way we have now hived off and isolated certain communities of people and put protective walls around them, which is a lot like medieval castles. You know, we've got people inside complexes now. We're abandoning public space more and more, and we're creating protected communities who are specialists. So I'm very interested in bioengineering, which is proceeding at leaps and bounds. And so is the creation of artificial food. You'll notice that Jimmy in his school cafeteria gets fish fingers, 20% real fish. Well, we're going to be lucky if it's 20%. although tilapia farming is coming on pretty strong, and the giganto salmon, have you seen it? This enormous salmon that they have engineered. So all of these are things that are happening now, and as with The Handmaid's Tale, into which I did not put anything that didn't have a precedent in human history. I didn't put in anything that is theoretically impossible. I stretched it a bit. My brother didn't endorse the purring of the created people, although my sister-in-law did. She too has a biological background. You'd have to do a fairly fancy bit of engineering to get there, but it's not impossible. So that's where it all came out of, plus the fact that we now do have the Pandora's box and we have taken the top off of it, and we do very much have the ability to create a virus or microbe to which nobody has got any immunity. I would not be a bit surprised if they're not doing that not so far from here. The problem with letting it out of the box is that, of course, your own side is going to get just as annihilated as the people you think you're directing it at. So unless you went about immunizing your whole population, which would be kind of a tip-off, and the other side would get hold of the vaccine, things being as porous as they are, and figure out pretty quickly what you had made and make their own vaccine. So it would be like that, but if you were prepared to really wipe the lot, there would be actually nothing to stop you.
So this connects a little bit to the monsters under the bed. So that kind of, those possibilities that exist, is that something with it, you know, just...
Does it worry me a lot?
Yeah. Do you move into a state of paralysis about that monster? Or do
no.
you name the monster?
No.
You name, you
no.
describe the monster, don't
yes.
you, to us?
Yes. let me put it this way. Somebody said to me, well, looking 30 years down the line, what do you think? And I said, it's actually not going to be my problem.
Yes, but
it's going to be your problem. So, you know, that's the alert. Then, of course, it's up to other people, to younger people, mm-hmm. let me put it that way, younger people whose problem it will be to start thinking about how to deal with what's coming down the pipeline. And they are thinking about it. There's a lot of thinking going on. It is really a race against time in which people are developing all sorts of technologies to deal with, for instance, our carbon emission problem, our energy problem, our food problem, our water problem. People are working very hard on solutions to those, but it's a race.
Well, in that way, it almost seems like the storyteller has a prophetic quality.
I don't do prophecy. Uh-huh,
right. Yeah, so that may not be your intention, but it may be...
I don't do prophecy uh-huh. because there are too many variables.
Right.
Even the prophets didn't really do prophecy. Mm-hmm. What they were really doing was reading into what they saw in front
right.
of them.
Yeah, that's the way I'm using that term. The
yeah,
prophetic
sure.
quality.
Yes. But you can't
sort of the
say,
Old Testament prophet.
This will happen.
No.
Because you don't know whether it will or not. Something else might come along that is quite different. Mm-hmm. And that you have not anticipated.
As it has in our times.
Just as you get your food supply nicely balanced in Pakistan, along comes a raging flood and sweeps it all out to sea. So what are you going to do about that? Mm-hmm. You didn't anticipate it. You had no way of
right.
preventing it, and you're left with a huge mess.
Mm-hmm.
Toxic sludge in Hungary. Well, somebody might have been able to figure that mm-hmm. one out.
But some of it
what
is...
What if this toxic sludge gets out of this vat and runs all mm-hmm. over the village? It won't be a bad thing.
I was talking with my friend about art, so I was curious how you would define art and whether or not it has to be beautiful in order to be considered art. Like
well...
how would you define it?
I don't define art, but it's things that people make. They used to be part of an entire ritualistic, cultural, combined narrative, religious ideas, ways of making more animals occur. You know, all of these mm-hmm. things were one. We've separated out certain aspects of that, such as what we view as cave art was undoubtedly at the time part of an evocation ritual. They wouldn't have called it art. They would have called it evoking more animals or something like that. So we've separated off some of those things and said, okay, these are for us to look at. But the roots of it go back to that unified cultural, religious, practical complex that was early culture. So I just think of it as stuff people make that they put a frame around, virtual or otherwise, and say, this is art. Anything you put inside that frame, it's almost by function. They also have, you know, applied arts and design and all those kinds of things. That's usually thought of as decorating something that has a more practical function, like you put a flower on your mix master or something like that. But it's all stuff that people make, and it's all from that root word that means articulated. So arthritis, arthropod, art, something that has joints. So it moves, and the god in charge of that is Hermes, who is in charge of so much. Apollo is in charge of making stuff beautiful, so form, balance, harmony, those sorts of things. There are two Greek gods who had to do with art. Athene had more to do with applied arts, like weaving. But weaving, of course, can also be art. Look at Penelope and her interesting shroud, which was pictorial. It wasn't just a piece of white fabric. So help yourself. It's up for grabs. People have been trying to define it forever. And yet sometimes it's used in this way. Well, this is art, meaning it's good. But this isn't art, meaning it's bad. It's actually all art. Then you can make a judgment about whether you think it's good art or bad art, but it actually is all art. You can say this art sucks, but it's art. He's a good artist, he's a bad artist. They're both artists.
My name is Dima. I found that in your poetry and The Handmaid's Tale, the messages of feminism or environmentalism, they're all centered around the preservation of the essence of life, like the freedom of living. Could you elaborate on what inspires this consciousness in you and how you developed this sort of sense?
Everybody's very keen on this idea of inspiration. Why is that? Because you want to be able to pop a pill, breathe in some magic fumes, and get a bunch of ideas. It's not like that. If you want to have some ideas, I can tell you how to get them. Would you like to know? Okay, so here's how. You put your left hand on the ground. You put your right hand into the air and you close your eyes. Stay like that. You'll get an idea. May take a while. You will eventually get one.
Do you do that?
No. As I say, practice.
You don't have to do that.
I don't have to. Uh-huh. But if people are hankering for one and they feel a vacancy, mm-hmm. they feel a lack of ideas, that's how they can get the process going. The old prophets and indeed shamans used to fast in isolation, and you'll get a lot of ideas that way, but you may think of them as hallucinations, but you will get some. Fast in isolation long enough, and trust me, you will get some visitations.
My name is Diana, and I'm taking this course called Playwriting. Mm-hmm. And for every week, we have to hand in play, and we talk about our plays.
Okay.
So we get comments and criticism. And since you have been writer for a long time, I understand that you have got a lot of comments on your works and criticism. So I was wondering how you deal with those comments and criticism. How do you utilize them to develop your work? In addition to that, I'm also curious how much you rely on imagination and experience. Because personally, when I write, I feel it's really hard to rely purely on imagination. I borrow ideas from my own experience. It seems harder for me to just rely only on creativity.
Okay, first of all, everything is experience. By which I mean that even if you're thinking up an idea, you're experiencing that idea at the same time you're thinking it up. It almost doesn't matter where you get those things. It could be reading the newspaper, talking to your friend. It could be something you yourself did. It could be from any number of places, but it almost doesn't matter. It does matter if you're writing about something that's supposed to be real. Then people will expect your facts to be accurate. If you're writing about the Emperor Napoleon and he doesn't marry Josephine, you're in trouble. Because he actually did marry Josephine, and a lot of people will very much object if you change the known facts of his life. If you have him winning the Battle of Waterloo, it will be taken badly. So that's when it becomes important, simply because your readers will become very annoyed with you if you put in something that is palpably and demonstrably not true. But as for yourself, I would just, doesn't matter. And as for comments and criticism, they're important at the editing stage. After the book is published, it's too late. You can't change it, so they might as well just ignore it. It's interesting at the editing point, which is really at the point you're at. So you can use at this moment in your life, you can use these comments to presumably help in what you're doing, but I would also say if they don't make any sense to you at all, I would just discard them. It means the other person is wrong.
Thank you.
Speaking as a student in a liberal arts education, I see a lot of the rigidity in the Handmaid's Tale, the Republic, the fundamentalist Christian regime.
It's not Christian. Be careful about that. It's actually not Christian.
Well, fundamentalist,
yes.
Nevertheless. I see a lot of rigidity in our education system, going up, having a set curriculum,
mm-hmm.
and you have to do this, and you have to do that, and being graded in a set manner. And there's really, it limits your creativity, and it confines you to a certain capacity. And I was just wondering what your thoughts on that.
Okay, first of all, nobody's forcing you. This is not a jail.
Mm-hmm.
You can always leave. Second, what is your goal? Will this help you achieve your goal, or will it not? Do you know what your goal is? If you don't, then maybe that's one of the things that you're here to find out. Third, every area of human endeavor has a discipline. For instance, you cannot suddenly burst into being Mozart without learning music. It just doesn't happen. So there's a certain amount of discipline involved in anything. Fourthly, there's no such thing as unlimited creativity. It would just be formless and a void. Any piece of art has structural principles. Whether it's good art or bad art, it still has them. So one of the things you're presumably learning is what is the function of structure. I can't speak to the curriculum here because I don't know anything about it. But I would say that if you're taking subjects that you're not happy with, maybe you should be taking other subjects.
But they don't let you.
They don't let you.
Who
you
is, have to take, like,
who is they? Who is they?
The curriculum coordinator.
Who is have to? There is no actual have to in your life. You don't have to. You have to if you want to achieve the package that presumably awaits you at the end of this process. That would be called graduating.
A diploma.
Yeah. Then there are certain things that you have to fulfill. Just as in any treasure hunt, you're supposed to collect this thing, and then there's a little message that tells you, go on, get that thing, and so on and so forth. But you don't have to be doing it. Nobody's making you. You have free will. Is it your parents? Are you here because your parents made you go? No. Is this your first year?
Yeah.
It gets better. I hated first year. And I didn't know what it was for, and I was quite confused. So that's a normal experience. It's chaotic, and you haven't figured it out yet. You haven't figured out what the rules are. So your response to that is to object to the fact that there are rules, but really it's just a matter of it's like any game. Football without rules would be impossible. And if you're playing it or watching it, it really does help to know what those rules are. Otherwise, it just looks like a bunch of idiots running around on the field. Yes, hockey, I understand. Soccer, I understand much better. Football, not particularly my thing. Australian rules, on the other hand. So every game has rules, everyone. And there are those ones of us who used to watch people playing chess in the really bad sports when they were losing. They would just overturn the chessboard. But that just means you're losing, right? Any game, bridge, hearts, poker, they've all got rules. And so does writing poetry, depending on what sort of poem you're writing. And it really helps you a lot to write sonnets. Then you understand that there are structural principles and that it's harder than you thought. The other thing about knowing the rules is it allows you to appreciate other people doing it well. My mother was an ice dancer until she was 75.
Wow.
She always watched the pairs skating during the Olympics because she understood how hard it was. And therefore, she had a real appreciation for what those people were able to do. So rules help you understand how well other people are doing things, and they also help you to learn how to do them better yourself.
So my question is just on creativity in general. My name is Clifford. We talked about genetic engineering as a form of creativity that's giving us problems now. Norris and Craig, the creative engineer, or the creatures that are engineered, literally come back to hunt and eat you.
Some do, others are pets.
Yeah, some do, others are cute, and others are friendly pets. And so this is along the question. I'm thinking of your book, The Robber Bride, where there's three women have imaginative ideals of themselves that become one woman, seeing it, that literally begins to rip their lives apart into shreds. And you talked yesterday of superheroes, personas that can empower you, can be awe-inspiring and beneficial, and save the world. So I guess, is there a line between creativity that gains a life and flesh of its own and begins to shred you to pieces and that saves the world?
Not all creativity is benevolent.
No. Yeah, that's true.
You can make a bad thing. That's just as creative as making a good thing. The mad scientist paradigm is there for a reason. So, yes, putting disparate things together into a third new thing. That third new thing is not always a good third new thing. It can be a bad new thing. It can be something you thought was going to be good, like the Frankenstein creature, and turns out to be ambiguous and then destructive. So, yes, we are the species that creates par excellence lots of new things. It's not that other animals can't think creatively, they surprisingly often can. But we really do. We've really taken it to a whole other level. That's an appropriate question. And there is often a things bite back factor, that we do something that we think is going to have beneficial effects, but we haven't anticipated this other effect over here. For instance, we worked very hard on the death rate. We got it down. We forgot to do anything about the birth rate. Now we've got problems.
Yes, one more question.
My question's actually a little bit related to yours, because I'm thinking about sort of, we talked about storytelling and art and how they relate to being human, but I'm wondering about the other species which figure so prominently in your work, and sort of, I was wondering if you could talk about how you see our relationship with other species, or maybe draw boundaries.
Okay, imagine an Earth with nothing on it alive but us. We'd be dead very quickly, because it is absolutely true that we are dependent on the life underground to even allow plants to grow, and we are dependent upon life in the sea to even create enough oxygen for us to breathe. We are dependent on forests for the same reason, and also have a lot to do with the rainfall cycle. We are intimately connected with these other life forms, much more so than people realize. You have a lot of them living in you, which if they did not live in you, you would be dead. We are symbiotic in that way. So it's not a question of thinking bunnies are cute or any of that. It's that without other life forms on the planet with us, we would not exist. Some people say, why should we be worried about all of this? And I say, 3 days without water and you're dead. And you cannot live without breathing oxygen. Now let's think about where that water and where that oxygen comes from. It's not generated out of your brain.
That connects to the idea of interdependence, which many of us were studying last week when the Dalai Lama was here.
Yes.
The interdependence of us all on each other and on the world surrounding us.
I'd reverse the importance of that. I'd put the world around us first.
First, absolutely, sure.
And then each other.
Right.
Sorry about that.
I would agree with that. I want to talk for a second about, and just conclude about the idea of a voice. A quotation from you is as follows: a word after a word after a word is power. And just what we've been talking about here is something about a creative power, an artistic power, the power to create things that are sometimes beyond what we imagined, what we thought we could imagine.
I'd say often way beyond.
Way beyond what we imagined. And I think when I was speaking of the prophetic quality, I wasn't necessarily meaning predictive quality, mm-hmm. that we can predict mm-hmm. what can happen, but we can imagine the circumstances in which we need to fashion a response or fashion a world or fashion a feeling that helps us deal with these, with the monsters, but also the possibilities that are out there. And so I guess my final question to you, do you see yourself as a person who is an optimist or a pessimist or a realist?
I love that question. Everybody is always so interested in that. Well, what is optimism, mm-hmm. really? And it's people who think that things are actually going to come out better than they are going to come out. What is it, pessimist? Or somebody who thinks that things are going to come out worse than they actually are going to come out. And a realist, on the other hand, thinks that things are going to come out about the way they are going to come out. Since we don't know how they're going to come out, there's actually not even any point thinking about that. So I can't tell you whether I'm an optimist or a pessimist. I can tell you that I'm a generally cheerful sort of person in my daily life, and that I cannot deal with world news before breakfast. Just verboten. I don't want to think about it or talk about it before that time. Are we living in difficult times? Yes. Are we living in times that are more difficult than, say, the year 1000, when people thought they were living in very difficult times? we actually realistically probably are. Have we really absorbed that news? No, we haven't. We would rather not think about that. We are very short-term thinkers as a species. We want to get through today. And then we want to get through this week. And if we can, we would like to get through this month and hopefully this year. And that's about as far as we can think. So do we see the implications of what we're doing? Well, we've been told about them, but it hasn't really sunk in. If our ancestors had said, well, I have this nice piece of moose, and I'm going to save it up for 3 years and not eat it, what would have happened to them? They would have starved. We are very much programmed to eat the low-hanging fruit, because that gets us to the end of this day, and then to the end of this week, and then to the end of this month. And we can't actually, because we're so embedded in time, we can't actually skip that part unless we have a large supply of freeze-dried food, which I have helpfully supplied my characters with in the year of the flood.
Right. Well, I was actually going to propose yet another possibility between pessimism and optimism and fatalism or determinism, or, you know, all
I'm
of those other...
fatalist or determinist, because there are too many variables.
Right. But I was thinking of a kind of different word, perhaps based on fantasy, the fantasies, not fantasy strictly as a literary form, but the fantasy of possibilities that exist. And by that, return to really the power of words and the imagination to move us in directions that we hadn't. There's both the quality of writing that reflects what's going on in the world, but that other quality that brings us to a new understanding of ourselves.
Well, this is a study for... somebody was talking to me last night about... He's a neurobiologist, and he was interested in how the brain processes stories.
Right.
So I leave that topic to them. If you're asking me how I do that...
No, I'm actually speaking more about, I guess I'm speaking more about the power that, not so much how you do it, but the power that all of us experience around the storytelling.
Okay, right. We experience that because we have mirror neurons. Anybody here a mirror neuron person? Okay, mirror neurons... You look at a small baby and stick out your tongue at it, and it will stick its tongue out back at you. It means it's got mirror neurons. Some people don't have them, and it means they have a lot of trouble feeling empathy. But if you do have mirror neurons, if somebody in a movie is in a really bad situation and they're awfully sad, you shed a tear. You've got mirror neurons. You empathize with what is being presented to you and told to you. So we're right there with young Jim Hawkins on the Hispaniola. As he's hiding in the apple barrel, it's scary. Or let me use a more pop culture image, Psycho. Don't check into that motel. Oh, no. Don't open that door. No. Don't open the box. Don't go into the crypt. We all know that those are scary things and that the person in the movie shouldn't be doing it. So we get quite anxious. We know something bad is going to happen, and it does. Because we are who we are able to empathize with a narrator or central figure who is being run through some stressful situations.
Right.
We feel those same emotions. I don't know how many versions of Henry V you've ever watched. I've watched several, including the original and the Kenneth Branagh one, and Shakespeare on stage. We got all revved up during that battle speech. It's the Battle of Agincourt. It took place hundreds of years ago. It's not material to us, but there we are, ready to go. That is what kind of being we are. I did have a friend who had a dog called Farley. His name was actually Farley. And he used to tell Farley the dog a story about Farley the dog. He could actually get Farley the dog to participate in the story. Not because it understood what was happening, but because it saw the emotions of its friend. And then Farley went running down the street, and Farley went, woof, 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 woof. So it participated, and that's what we do. We participate.
Well, I think that is actually a good way to close this conversation about creativity and participation, but also about the quality of empathy in reading about characters whose lives become our lives. And we feel like we're a part of that story. And the stories that you tell are in some way become our stories as well.
Well, that's lovely.
We're really grateful for that and grateful for your presence on our campus and your openness to our wide range of conversations and questions. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Creativity Conversations. This podcast was brought to you by Emory University and Arts at Emory. It was produced by Emma Yarbrough and me, Maggie Becker. For the full version of this conversation, you can find it on the Creativity Conversations YouTube playlist linked in the description of this episode. For more from Arts at Emory, be sure to follow us on Facebook at Arts at Emory and on Instagram at Emory Arts.